A red R appears in white circle. Beneath it appear the words, Rugged Entertainment. Gray block letters appear one by one, forming the words, Accelerator Media. An animated model of the New York City skyline appears. Beneath it, in block letters, are the words, Stone Films NYC. A black and white photo of a New York City street. A sign reads, Hotel Chelsea. Then photos of a dark-haired young man with Bono, John Lydon, and Debbie Harry.
Back then, every night I was going out to see music in New York City. And I'd be backstage, night after night, at a show or at a club. And I would just keep seeing the same person over and over again. Like a freaking specter. And I'd say to myself, who the fuck is that guy?
Caption, Rugged Entertainment and Accelerator Media in association with Mad Production presents a Stone Films NYC production. Author, Dito Montiel.
There's not many people out there I love, you know, including family. And he's one of them that I love. So with that comes chaos.
Caption, produced by Michael Alex and Drew Stone. Former Metallica bass player Jason Newsted.
There's no question at all, and no one could argue that if there wasn't for Michael, I wouldn't be where I am.
Caption, executive producers Peter Speyer, Gillian McCain, Rob Zombie, Michael Alex, Peter Darnell, Jane Omerod, and Vinayak Singh. Mina Caputo from Life of Agony.
He is a magnet for lots of autistic, buoyant things.
Title, Who the Fuck Is That Guy? The Fabulous Journey of Michael Alago, written and directed by Drew Stone. A&R executive Debbie Southwood Smith.
Only in New York could a Puerto Rican kid grow up in a Hasidic neighborhood, gay, and achieve what Michael achieved. They call it the land of opportunity. New York is the city of opportunity.
Caption, the journey begins. Michael Alago stands before an apartment building entrance.
Here we are in Borough Park in Brooklyn, and this is my old address, 5412 New Utrecht Avenue. I lived here from when I was about 12 years old till about maybe 18 or 19 years old, me, my mom, and my sister. And this is a railroad apartment. So when you walked into the apartment, you walked into the foyer, the kitchen, the dining room, my sister's room, my mother's room, and then my room, which was in the front of the building, which faced the B train, the elevated train, which trains were going by every 2 minutes. And believe it or not, I slept through all of that. Like that noise you're about to hear, I slept through every day for about 6 years. 6 years! I grew up in a household where you don't talk about anything. You don't tell people your business. What happens in the home stays in the home. And then, you know, as a grown man of 53, I sometimes question, well, why did they say that? Did shit happen in the home that I don't remember? It's heavy shit sometimes. It goes down. I have a younger sister. She's 4 years younger, my sister Cheryl.
I mean, soon as, you know, he could ride the train and get out of the house, he would be gone. Or he'd be locked. We had this small railroad apartment, and he would be locked in his room. His room was on the very end of the railroad apartment. He'd be locked in his room. The music would be blaring, and he just... he would spend hours in that room, hours, just listening to music.
A funny memory I have of high school, because, you know, now as a grown gay man, and I keep going back to this because so many kind of funny things happen. I had a math class, and there was a teacher that he was like this burly guy. And I always thought, oh, my God, he's so handsome. But I was like this little itty bitty 15-year-old, and he's the teacher, the math teacher. And I remember that there were a couple of kids in that math class that would always make fun of me because I was a bit effeminate. And this teacher got wind of this. And one day, he took these two kids' seats and just flipped them over on their sides. And they fell out of their seats. And he was like, you don't talk about people that way. And of course, me and my 15-year-old demented mind, I would be like, Oh, he loves me. But, you know, like, I just thought, but, like, whoa, that my teacher protected me. You know, in retrospect now, I think he was probably some, like, leather bear that went out on the weekends and just saw this, you know, petite thing that he didn't want anybody to fuck with.
The Empire State Building. Graffiti on a wall reads, "Death to crack dealers." The Wonder Wheel at Coney Island. Protesters hold a banner that reads, "Lower East Side, this land is ours." The marquee at the Big Apple Theater reads, "French Lust Porno Tram." Caption, "Brooklyn 1976. A photo of a young, long-haired Michael Alago.
So here I am, young 16-year-old, and I'm out all the time. I don't know why my mother let me go out every night, but I take the B train into the city. And if I was going to Max's, I would change trains somewhere along the way and get on the double R or the N to 14th Street and Union Square and head up to Max's Kansas City, which I believe was on 18th and Park. It was extraordinary why they let me in there. I have no idea, because I was underage. I was 16 and I looked like I was 12 and a half. It was crazy. I mean, people like Johnny Thunders, Cherry Vanilla,
Lee Radzwell and Truman Capote and a hooker, a female hooker, a male hooker, a fortune teller girl, a fledgling rock star. Everybody would be thrown in this tight atmosphere together.
There were so many up-and-coming artists that played Max's. Now, keep in mind, back in the day, if you played Max's, you didn't play CBGB's and vice versa. There was this thing that you were a Max's band or you were a CB's band. I don't know how Suicide got away with that, because they did many a night at CB's, and I know they've played a few times at Max's, because that's initially where I met Alan Vega, after he practically chased the whole room out because he was wild and crazy and banging the mic on his head and busting open his lip. And I would sit there, like, adoring, loving the music of Suicide. I was a wild child who knew that there was always something going on in New York City. And if I found it in the Village Voice and I liked it, I went to see it. Every night of the week, we were out. If we weren't at Lismar Lounge, we were on Avenue B somewhere. And if it was a real late night, you were at Save the Robots, you were at Crisco Disco, you were at The World. And the East Village was a little more than funky.
One of the first times we were here, we stayed up at some hotel up in Midtown. I think it was like the Taft Hotel or something like that. And there, well, one of the first guys we saw was that drummer guy from the movie Taxi Driver. And, you know, got down to St. Mark's Place. They still had carts on the sides of the streets. You know, they didn't have the Hooper Scooper law, so people walking around talking to themselves, and very skeevy bunch of people. It was pretty cool, you know. We thought it was great.
I was fearless back then, and the Bowery was filthy, dirty, and kind of scary to a youngster from Brooklyn. But I felt that there was a scene happening, and I wanted to be part of that scene.
It was so full of creativity. Patty Astor was opening up the Fun Gallery. She probably was the first person to show Keith Haring and Jean-Michel Basquiat and all these great people. So it was electric, the East Village in the 80s.
Really fantastically thrilling place. These great stores, shops, cafes, bars. All manner of coincidences would take place. You'd meet such thrillingly different people with different cliques. This is always a great thrill to me, because being brought up in London, you don't get that same kind of mad mixture of exciting, interesting people, departmentalized by the English way. New York broke all those rules, and you'd find yourself sitting next to an author, a filmmaker, another band member, and there'd be no hatred or animosity or jealousy going on. Absolutely fantastic.
For me, it was great times, because it was everything I wanted New York to be before I got there. You wanted to step out and go, oh my God, there's Andy Warhol walking across the street. Oh, look, the Ramones are over there. Well, it was still everything that in my mind was still happening. It hadn't gone away yet.
It was an amazing, vibrant scene. Basically, a giant kindergarten being run by the kindergartners, except they were all on drugs and when tattoos meant something and all of that stuff.
You know, you gotta understand, it wasn't just the music, it was the fashion. It was the that people were coming into the city, and it was, you know, vintage, and it was new, and it was trash and vaudeville, and it was, oh my God, I had finally gotten out of Queens, you know, not for nothing. I love Queens. I'm bridge and tunnel, but I finally left. And I mean, like, I didn't have to dress like, you know, I couldn't dress like that and go back to Queens. Every time I did, or when I first did, I had rocks thrown at me. So to be back and to be at the beginning of something and you didn't know what it was quite, you knew, well, you go downtown and go to CB's and you could see Annie Golden in the shirts and you could see the Ramones and you could see Blondie.
From the rock and roll perspective, we were out every night. You could be at the Garden at 8 o'clock, but you know you got to make that first set at the Cat Club if it was a Wednesday at 10:30. And then, oh shit, we got to go down to CB's because somebody good's playing at 1 a.m. And once you're on that roll, which was so incredible, you were out all night. I was out all night. And, you know, that was the beauty of New York then. Every night we were out somewhere.
Michael Lago is someone who could only come out of New York in the 80s. You know, if you look at the sort of...
Mike Gitter.
The spirit, the, you know, his bacchanal nature, you know, his kindness, his openness, his intensity. That's New York before New York became sanitized.
Michael.
The world was definitely different prior to AIDS. You know, this sounds a little corny, but like there's free love almost, but that sounds very 60s free love. One can say is in New York City prior to AIDS, the gay scene was very, very vibrant. But like in any big city, whether it is New York or San Francisco, people were out there having sex all the time. I mean, just, you know, here in New York, at one point I lived at 763 Washington Street in the early 80s. And Washington Street alone was filled with the underground S&M clubs, gay S&M clubs. I mean, there was the Mineshaft. There was the Anvil. And then once you started walking the Walk of Shame for late night on West Street, you were going to go to the Eagle's Nest or the Spike. And, you know, that was the run you did. And remember... Men, gay men, cruised all the time. There was no internet. There was no thingy on your phone where you see, oh, that person's 10 feet away from me. You know, you reacted to somebody based on like almost this like animal attraction. I can remember coming home late at night from one of the gay bars and the telephone would ring. And of course, I'd be a little drunk and I'd pick up the phone and be like, hey, and the person would say, look up. And inevitably, the person was jerking off in the window. And you'd look up and you'd scrutinize them and go, oh, you're fucking hot, man. Yeah, what's the buzzer number? 2. Okay, I'll be right up. You go up, you have a whack, and you do your business. And then you just come back down and you keep walking. But that was like a thing in all like of the gay areas, that if the phone rang, you knew that was the person nearby. Did they see you from a window? It was crazy. But you know what? Those were the things that were going on.
I remember those phones ringing all over New York. I'd always answer it and they'd always be like, hi. And I'd be like, fuck you. You know, they're like, so I didn't know that that was what was actually the next, if the conversation got going, I didn't know that that's where it was going. That's kind of great to know.
Me and my friend Jody Ribello were young people who were active photographers back then and fans. And we decided we want to make a zine for the Dead Boys. And we want to like run their fan club. What do we know about running a fan club? Except that you Xerox pictures and you cut out letters and you pasted them and it said Dead Boys Fan Club and all these odd letters. But it's the makings of, you know, punk rock.
The cover of the Dead Boys Sonic Reducer album.
Back then, they were the most exciting band I've ever seen. What a front man Steve Bader's was. He was like the bastard child of Iggy Pop. These guys from Youngstown, Ohio, come to New York and fucking kick ass at CBGB's. You know, they would come out and open with Sonic Reducer. And at one point, you know, Steve was just like kind of shaking it up there. And he would come out with this nice white blazer and he'd rip off the blazer. And they would be, and he'd have like vinyl on. And clipped on the vinyl were pieces of bologna. And you would think, what the fuck is, what's going on here? And at some point, he's like crazy and into the music, and he would rip the bologna off, blow his nose in the bologna, and then chew the bologna and swallow it. And, you know, that was so punk rock. That was so fun. That was like, oh, my God, what did Stiv Bators do? Here's Stiv probably spitting out the bologna, like almost like he's jerking off his throat. We would sit at the lip of the stage at the concert at CB's, and we would just be in, you know, rock and roll heaven, because we also, we knew the bands, you know. And when you knew the bands, you know, you felt special. But like I said, I was a fan from Brooklyn who just loved music.
Well, I mean, there's normal kids from, like, Brooklyn, Queens. It wasn't like, you know, people with, you know, razor blades. It wasn't like the London scene where everybody was all dressed up. These were like normal kids. They were really into it. I mean, the energy just poured on us for them. It was great. I mean, they loved us, and we could tell, and we loved them.
I started working in a pharmacy when I graduated. High school, 1 year School of Visual Arts, and it was at Astor Place.
The building behind us, this huge building, back in the day was called District 65. It was a municipal workers' union. And in the summer of 1980, my dad got me my first job there in the shipping and receiving department.
One day I was taking lunch, and I was on 11th Street between 3rd and 4th Avenue. And there was a building there that was there forever. And at the time it was called Casa Galicia. It was a Spanish dance hall. But the sign said that there was a dance club that was going to be opening there, and that to drop off your resume. So I just decided, I'm going in this club. I want to see what it looks like. We all know it in the 80s as the Ritz.
Michael enters the club.
This is great. Here we are at Webster Hall, which back in the day was called the Ritz. I got my first job in the music business here. It was the summer of 1980.
When Michael was at the Ritz, I mean, it was such an unbelievable time, particularly for the bands that were coming up, the British bands. I mean, just like, it's phenomenal to think that we saw Duran Duran, Adam and the Ants, Simple Minds, U2, at the Ritz when they were playing their first American tours.
You got to give credit to Jerry Brandt for recognizing the energy and the enthusiasm of Michael, because that's what you need in this business.
One day, this little kid walked in, and I assumed, I said, can I help you? Because that's the way I am.
I was like, yeah, I want a job.
And there was something about him that was interesting.
Jerry Brandt.
And he said, I'm Michael Lago, and blah, blah, blah.
And he said, do you have a resume?
Michael crestfallen.
I was like, a resume? I go to School of Visual Arts, and I work in a pharmacy on Astor Place.
And I kept looking at him. He had this sparkle in his eye, and curiosity abounded. So I gave him a job.
Fast forward a little bit, you know, it's now 1980, and, you know, all that energy and stuff from when I was a teenager just saying, I want to be in the music business. Well, it finally happened. I got my first job at the Ritz.
In a very short time, he became my assistant, and then he was doing everything from the contracts to listening to all my phone calls, picking up contracts, delivering contracts.
And I think what he liked about me as a young person was my exuberance, and that I knew about everything from the Great American Songbook to heavy metal, because my love for music was that varied. And he hired me as his assistant.
I always asked him about bands because he was young and I was in my 40s, and his ear was closer to the ground.
So he eventually became the booker at the Ritz.
This guy, Michael Lago, booked so many legendary shows in New York City. The Ritz was so important with Michael because, like, again, he's the guy that fought for, like, that band's gonna play, you know? Again, the guy, like, he's the one bringing in all this great music. He's the one who booked those shows. He's the one that pulled all those great bands in, you know? Yeah, could it have been someone else? Maybe, maybe not, but it was him.
It was extremely exciting. I was so happy to be a part, and you could go to the Ritz and see everybody from Tina Turner to the Specials. We were part of this worldwide new music thing that was happening. It was coming from England. It was coming from New York. It was coming from Australia. It was exciting. And it was come from Germany.
That was a fantastic period in New York. It was like a little bit of a revival of the kind of 1975, 76 period. That was a little later, when things were waning a little, and then that kind of brought it all back to rock and roll for a while.
It was also, as far as I know, the first club that had major...
Danny Fields.
Dancing to the music called rock and roll with videos. I thought it was amazingly beautiful that you heard rock and roll. There was something to look at and the dance floor. And I thought that was... very few people have put that together.
Caption: Alago books Bow Wow Wow into the Ritz. 2 days before the show, they cancel. Public Image Limited agree to step in and do the show.
So Flowers of Romance is coming out, so Michael books them at the Ritz. I don't think he knew, nobody in the crowd knew that the band was going to be doing this performance art thing behind this screen.
I warned him. I said, if you mess up with the screen, you're going to have to pay.
You knew there was an energy in that room that something was going down, something was happening, and you were at the right place at the right time if you wanted to experience that.
And then eventually the music starts, and it's just the Flowers of Romance song where they're just pounding drums away, and the band is behind the screen, and they're not coming out, and the crowd is starting to get restless.
And the screen being down and white was obviously the enemy. It was the big white enemy because it was keeping away the people, the celebrated Johnny Rotten, whom you came to see. Fuck B.I.L. I want to see Johnny Rotten in action.
And kids started throwing bottles. It was wicked. They wouldn't perform in front of the screen.
We never intended to play a live gig. It was never meant to be. It was a video performance.
They're on the stage, some people, and they pull down the screen. The band leaves. It's so chaotic. I don't know who got hurt. The security gets involved. You know how security can get involved with some sort of these kind of shows. I don't know where the band went at that point, but I'm sure everybody just wanted to kill Johnny.
Let's say, you know, by a modern comparison, I had a Bieber moment.
John Lydon grins.
It's all very, very much B-movie stuff when I look back on it. But at the same time, I look back on it really warmly. It was funny. I mean, the prospect of facing a riot was, it just honestly seemed hilarious to me. And I think that made the audience laugh too. And it became ridiculous, you know. This is pills. It's not my pistols stuff going on here. We're more thinking in the world. And so we won over on a glorious combination of intellectualism and alcoholism. Hey, the drinks are on me. That's how you stop a riot.
Cherry Vanilla.
I wouldn't call him a hustler like Jerry Brandt, but he was out to make it in the music business, and you knew it. As cute and as sweet and as friendly and as enthusiastic as he was also pretty seriously aggressive.
At some point, I'm ready to leave the Ritz, and Jerry Brandt called Bob Krasnow and at Elektra Records, and the next thing you know, I got my first job as an A&R executive.
A&R, Artists in Repertoire. Being an A&R executive was a dream job for a music fan like me. You do everything with the artist, from helping them decide what songs to record, to hiring producers, going in the studio, and even working on album cover art. I had a huge expense account, so it was a constant party, and drinks were always on me. But by far, the best part of A&R is finding, signing, and developing new talent.
You are getting paid to do what you love, and you do have this expense account. And I believe in the beginning, for both of us, there was this innocence to it that you didn't quite realize that you weren't still that kid on the street that was just going out to see bands all the time.
This is too funny. This is too great. Here we are at 1546 62nd Street, home of L'Amour's.
Photos of heavy metal bands performing, gig posters, crowds of fist-pumping fans. A sign reads, "Lemoore Rocks."
This is totally blowing my mind because I haven't been to this neighborhood in years. You know, back in the day, for a young band to come and play at Lemoore's was like the pinnacle for them. They went to like heaven. It was like, you know, oh, the equivalent of playing, you know, like Madison Square Garden. I just remember getting so tanked here many a night. But you know what? This was the place where all of us young people, teenagers, came to see our favorite bands in a venue that was basically a small venue. You were right up front. You got to see and hear everything. And the shows were extraordinary. You know, like CBGB's in New York City, this was the place to be. This was the place to be. Prior to us knowing about Metallica, Slayer, Creator, King Diamond, all those people, we were listening to Black Sabbath, Iron Maiden, Judas. Those are the staples of rock and roll. And that's what we were loving. And then all of a sudden, this important little cassette came across my desk.
I have a distinct memory of Michael calling me. It's like, look, we're going to go to Lemoore's in Brooklyn, and we're going to go see this band Metallica.
It was the Metallica demo that kids were, like, raving about. But, you know, like I said, keep in mind, it's a young scene, it's underground, and it's all word of mouth.
I mean, at that point in time with the music scene that was going on, the heavy metal scene, it was really exciting because it was a bonding, galvanizing kind of thing for that generation, for our age group. It was our music, and it was happening, and it was going, and people were digging it, and there was energy and excitement. So here comes Michael.
August.
Lars Ulrich.
1984. Uptown a little bit, at the Roseland. Metallica, Raven, and Anthrax. It was in, like I said, in early August. You know, the first big show that we were playing in New York. Obviously, Roseland was an important place at that time. And there we were. We played. We were sandwiched. Anthrax opened. We were in the middle, and Raven were closing.
And they blew Raven off the stage, and Anthrax opened for them. It was like, at Roseland. I mean, Burton was still alive. That was that come to Jesus moment in music when you just like, you're like, holy cow, this shit is powerful.
The electricity in the air at Roseland was so high. It was sold out. None of these bands are on the radio or anything. Like I said earlier, cassettes are being traded. Homemade flyers are being passed out. Come see my band. The kids in the audience knew they were going to experience something that was going to rip their fucking head off. And it did. And that was the beginning of my total love for Metallica.
I'll never forget. He's like literally like busted into the room, screaming at the top of his voice, "You guys are great! I love you guys!" He's hugging us, kissing us, you know. And we're going, "Yes, Michael. Yes, Michael. Yes, Michael." And you know that was really the beginning of the relationship. Really, that night was like the launch pad.
You know, I'm so glad that Ulaga showed up to see us live. I mean, that is
James Hetfield.
That's the you know, for me, if you're a musician, you can be amazing in the studio. You can do all this amazing stuff. But until I see somebody live.
Cherry Vanilla.
Michael was 21 and they made him an A&R man. And he brought them Metallica, one of the biggest names of all time, plus other groups, but Metallica.
I could sense that something really big was happening here because they were bringing punk and metal together. And the guys were great, and Michael hit it off with them. And I remember hanging out with them. They were really, really down to earth. One of them in particular, Cliff, who, you know, sadly enough, you know, is not here anymore, was kind of like a hippie. I remember talking to him about music at Lemoore, and he was telling me about how much he was into Simon and Garfunkel and singer-songwriter stuff. And I was just like, wow, how freaking awesome is this? It's like These guys are really into music, and they're not just into, like, you know, thrash metal and punk. They're into a lot of different music.
You know, there were parallels because, you know, Michael Alago was an outsider in a mainstream kind of environment, and we always considered ourselves to be outsiders in a sort of potentially, you know, mainstream environment. And so it, in some way you could argue, maybe it wasn't clear at that time, but you could argue that we were perfect for each other, you know?
Yeah, we were on Megaforce Records with Johnny Zazula and his wife, and they'd pretty much taken us to where we were at that point. Not that they couldn't have taken us farther, but this was an opportunity, and I'm sure they knew this was going to come at some point. And it's, you know, you're helping a baby grow, and at some point it's going to walk on its own, and you wave goodbye.
The whole thing was really about, like, is it possible? We didn't know. Is it possible to be on a major label without feeling that you're selling out? Is it possible to be associated with a major label and feel that you still have freedom to be who you want to be, you know, and kind of play by your own rules?
Alago took us into a new world of Elektra Records, a major label, and it was game on. There was, wow, okay, we're getting this tour now. And the pluses of that in the day were huge.
He had a vision for us that I don't think we necessarily were aware of. Yeah, when we delivered Master of Puppets, it was a pretty huge thing for everyone. Michael was just so excited. I think the prevailing sort of thought was that, you know, we had done something that was gonna really just put us on the map, and that was gonna speak for us for years to come.
Little gay guy from
Phil Anselmo,
New York City, signs at the time probably the most innovative, groundbreaking band in Metallica, and then obviously White Zombie later on in his career and whatnot. To me, it just shows, once again, no matter who you are in your personal life and whatever you do with that, it makes no difference if you are a music fan.
I mean, who just thought an open guy would be really running the heavy metal band of the decade at that time? Like, fantastic. It worked a treat, and they're all still mates. I think in all ways of life, the situations that happen and work the best are the ones that you would least expect. And so it's that juxtaposition of events that on paper would look like a no-hoper. But there you go.
I think, you know, the example that Michael provided, you can take something that exists in its own universe and its own culture and doesn't necessarily have to fit in every bread box. And it can become, you know, it can become the mainstream.
Caption: after a storied career at Elektra, Alago moved on to Geffen Records. Michael stands under a street sign that reads, Sunset Boulevard, 9100 West.
Here we are in West Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard. I'm standing on the corner of Carroll Drive, a home of former home of Geffen Records, 9130 Sunset. This whole entire block, these series of bungalows from Carroll down to Doheny, was the record company. I got here in 1990 to start working, and the first band I signed was White Zombie. At the time, we had Cher, Guns N' Roses, Beck, Whitesnake, Sonic Youth. It was a flurry of incredible creativity, activity. It was almost like we could do no wrong.
Well, White Zombie had been on Caroline Records, and we kind of felt like everyone around us was getting signed to majors right then, and that maybe we could too, which is kind of outrageous we thought that, because we weren't commercial in any way or major label material. But we just felt like, you know, we've been slogging away for 4 years and maybe, you know, we could jump on that. I don't know, as soon as we started thinking about it, all of a sudden somehow we got connected with RCA Records and MCA Records, and people started asking us for meetings, and we met with them, but we didn't feel right about them. Like, they would come and like we'd go in their office and they'd be like, oh, White Zombie is really street. You know, we're like, oh, God, that doesn't sound good.
I did God of Thunder EP, and that was kind of a bridge between the old noisy White Zombie and a little more mainstream rock. And we were messing around with the sampler. You know, that was the early days of sampling. You could take a sound off of a movie and slip it into your thing. So Rob was interested in that. We were throwing horror samples in the songs, just kind of a foresight of what was to come. I tried to bring them to RCA with Circus of Power and Raging Slab, but I knew that RCA wasn't the good home for them. So I kind of just went to the motions of bringing them to RCA. But really, Alago over at Geffen was the place that they should go.
Geffen, now that's a cool label. You know, they were just signing Sonic Youth and Nirvana, and you know, they had Guns N' Roses that were doing great. So we were really excited to meet this guy from Geffen, and Daniel actually brought him to one of our shows at that time, which was this place called 428 Lafayette, or it was Club 428 or 428 Lafayette, which was the address.
In the corner, in the back, in the dark, were these four young people making noise. It was fucking noise. I don't think I didn't hear a song. But what I saw was this crazy, wild charisma that I felt from them. They were rocking. It was noisy. Like I said, I don't remember them it being songs, but for me, at that point in time, being a young A&R person in the music business, I just loved the energy. I could give a shit if a song was going to get fucking played on the radio or anything. I just loved this noisy energy.
Michael could see the art in something, even if it was just chaos to somebody else. He could see what it could be. Because whatever we became, whatever we became successful for, we had very little of it other than someone coming in going, wow, what they're doing, no one else is doing. And they have some rough version of the full package. I mean, you know, it was pretty raw. But that's the key of being a great A&R guy. Once it's polished, everyone can see it. You got to see it when it's raw. You got to be the person who signs it when no one else wants it. And that's what he did.
It was wild. I loved it. I thought it was just great. And when they came off stage, you know, the dreadlocks were hanging all over the place of Rob. And they were the funniest, loveliest people that I've ever met.
I remember it clearly. It seemed like we had one song that he liked. And I don't even know if he liked the whole song. We had one riff of one song he would always talk about. And it seemed like he signed us just based on that. Literally just based on that.
That to me is the mark of like great A&R, is having that, you know, that sense of vision. Of seeing something that's not, you know, not formed in the that's a zygote at best. And, you know, seeing, you know, wanting to see that ember sort of like fan into a fucking inferno.
Once again, his honest, brutal love for music, not only shining, but also looking into the future as well, which is an incredible gift, really.
A little dangerous. Something about him was a little dangerous at the time, which, you know, we liked. And he also really liked our drummer. We had a big, muscly, tattooed, cute, he's still in high school, drummer to Alago called Sweet Ivan. oh, dear, Sweet Ivan. Oh, Sweet Ivan. And I don't know. I always thank the Lord that, you know, Ivan was in our band or we might have never got signed to Geffen.
I was a gay record executive. Keep in mind, I love heavy metal. I love the noise. I love the sweat. I love when I go to concerts, it's 99% guys there.
I mean, why wouldn't he? I mean, what is he gonna love? You go to a show and it's just like, you know, a bunch of jacked up guys on steroids with their shirts off pounding the crap out of each other. He's in heaven.
There was never any name calling. But the thing that always, you know, what I always thought was, if the right word is funny, is keep in mind, everyone who came to see me as an A&R executive at Elektra or Geffen knew, like, oh, Alago loves metal. He signed Metallica. He signed Metal Church. He signed Flotsam. He works with George Lynch. So, you know, in a weird way, those young people who you may have thought were homophobic had to kind of put up with me
because I don't want to say put up with me or tolerate, because I hate those words, because I hate being tolerated, because one always wants to be respected. But those young people had to put up with me because I was the person they would come to for the record deal. And I think the beauty of all that is that they have may not ever met a gay person in their whole life. And the whole thing that they could come to my office and we could sit behind closed doors and listen to music really loud and they could play me their demo. And they saw that, oh, you know, that guy's cool. And they would maybe leave my office with a different perspective of what gay meant.
It made him stand out amongst a lot of the, all the other record and industry people that we had come to meet over the period of time. Michael stood out in that way, in that maybe, you know, his perspective was different because of his sexuality. Maybe he stood out in the way that in a really kind of, like, I hate to say it, homophobic sort of a genre, he was brave enough to stand there and be honest and be comfortable with who he was.
But it was just pretty ironic how the whole, you know, hardcore thing and the metal things, old macho tough guys, and then, you know, here's Michael, and everybody embraced him.
Fantastic. You got to be knowing that people that are completely themselves and at one with themselves are the easiest people in the world to get along with. And I think that that's how we work as friends, because there's no hidden agenda. Fantastic. And for that, he doesn't need to lie, and he doesn't. To this day, I tell you, I don't know any lie he's ever said. There might be a few out there to contradict me, but I would more than likely think they were lying.
I have to say that being, you know, raised in a very sheltered place in a church-going family as a kid in Michigan, coming on a farm and everything, I was never exposed to any of this type of things, alternative lifestyles. I came up as a teenager of the 70s. I never really got exposed to much of that at all. After time went by and I looked back and see what brothers and my brother's friends, which ones were gay or different things like this, I realize it now or then when I finally figured those things out. But Michael, it was one of the things we did know about him right away. There's one things that people would tell you about him or whatever. So for me, it was new, that part of thing in that whole, I mean, in the world, you know, because you got to think about, I was in Flotsam for a few years as we got the deal and all that. Halloween of 86 is the last show I did with Flotsam, loaded my own SVT into my truck, drove back home. 10 days later, I'm playing a sold-out Budokan with Metallica. I never did any of the thing about traveling around the countryside playing shows. I'd only ever played in Arizona and California by the time that I joined Metallica. So my exposure to things, it was all very quick. It was very much a whirlwind. Once I joined Metallica, started traveling around the world, everything was new to me.
When we met, you know, I met, you know, obviously Michael was gay because he found flamboyant in that way. And when I went, oh, wow, it's almost like I have an ally, you know, because the rest of the guys in the band knew I was. I've always been basically out, but within my circle of people, but never out publicly or anything, because I never felt that was necessary or anybody's business for that matter. But meeting Michael and in that thing, and then when I told him I was gay, he was, you know, it was one of those moments like, really? You know, you're in the band and you play guitar in a metal band and you're, if I was the singer or something, maybe, you know, that would, because like, you know, the Rob Halfords, the Freddie Mercurys and all that, there's something in there. But so we immediately became great friends and have been friends all these years ever since. And that is probably why.
I've seen him hang with the hardest guys that you look at the wrong way, you end up in the river in New York City. They will take you apart. And who's front and center talking with these guys about music, common ground? Michael Alago.
You know, we went to a lot of shows together, but it was always like the Cro-Mags or something. So we'd be at some show, some small club, just because he loved the Cro-Mags. You know, to him, they were the next Metallica. And it was like nothing but the filthiest, nastiest, meanest looking skinheads everywhere. And Michael, without a doubt, would always point out the biggest, meanest-looking tattooed skinhead he could find, fixate on him like, that's my boyfriend for tonight. I'm like, please don't do this. You're going to get yourself killed. But I somehow knew he wouldn't.
Rob Zombie.
And he would get lost in the crowd. I'd lose him. I'd go home. Next time I talked to him, he would bring it up, go like, you know, relate the story of how it all worked out the way he wanted it to work out that night with whatever, you know, maniac he found, and of course always had Polaroids to prove it. And just the amount of times that he did that was just incredible.
He always gets involved with people that are in it and are real about it. You know, when he saw the Cro-Mags, regardless of the history of the band and all the bullshit, whatever, nobody could say in the 80s when you came to see the Cro-Mags that we didn't put on a fucking sick show and we were all about it and left everything on the stage every fucking night. That's why he liked the Cro-Mags. Same with Metallica. Same with, you know, all the bands he's worked with, Rob Zombie, or all the bands, you know, he, like I said, he ran the Dead Boys fan club. Anybody that saw the Dead Boys knew they put on a fucking tremendous show.
With Michael, it wasn't like Michael ever wanted to say to me, you should sound like this or you should sound like that. The one comment Michael always said to me was, you should sound like yourself. That doesn't sound like you. That could be anybody. And that kind of resonated. And it's hard because sometimes you want to kind of lose yourself and grow.
Cyndi Lauper.
But there's always got to be a way that you could lose yourself and grow and still sound like you. And I guess that's the trick of it, isn't it? And that's why you need people like Michael.
So basically, you ran the gamut of the rock star life. Like, you did a lot of stuff having to do with, like, heavy metal, R&B. It ran the gamut with you. So it's like, you wore a lot of hats during your time in the music industry.
Yeah, I did. But that was okay. I mean, it was a fun time. And there was so much great music out there. And I never wanted to just be categorized as, he's the guy you go to for heavy metal. But I was. But like I said, I just love music, so I love the diverse range of artists that I worked with, whether it was Johnny Rotten from Public Image Limited or A&R-ing the first Tracy Chapman album.
Now, speaking of the best, you know, legendary status, Nina Simone.
Oh, Nina Simone. She was like my idol.
Nina Simone was big in Michael's life. He talked about her all the time to me and my mother. Who she was, took pictures with her, what she meant to him. Just big.
She was certifiably insane and unmanageable by anybody.
Carol Friedman.
She was brilliant. She was a genius. She was in the top 10 important vocalists in the history of singers. So when I get wind of this, that he's got Nina, I couldn't even believe it.
Nina Simone?
That's like producing God, you know, I mean.
Cherry Vanilla.
Michael is producing, as much as I thought of Michael, which was a lot. You know, Michael was Metallica and David Bowie and all that kind of stuff. But Nina Simone?
On stage, Nina Simone rises from her piano and stares intently at the audience. Eric Bogosian.
Yeah, money. People like making money, and Michael's been involved in plenty of commercial things, but when he was really into the Nina Simone's work and working with Nina Simone, this is not about money. This is about pure art. This is about loving art. And Michael loves the things that he loves.
There's a Nina Simone song called Everything Must Change. And in it, she snaps in a live version of it. And he used to point that out to me. He'd play it. He'd play that snap over and over. And he loved it so much. And it sounds crazy, but as an artist, you know, I would relate. Like you hear that magic. Like, wow, like he would assign Nina Simone if she just did that snap. You know what I mean? Like, who cares if she does a great version of Here Comes the Sun, that snap, you know?
Nina Simone, by anyone else's standards, or by many people's standards, was finished. But Michael had another idea.
Our journey has brought us here to Hollywood, California, specifically to Franklin Avenue, where my friend Nina Simone lived for many, many years in the 80s, 90s. Until she passed in 2003. I would come and visit her here every time I came to California, and specifically because we were going to be making a record. And there were two albums that we referenced a lot, Billie Holiday's Lady in Satin
and Frank Sinatra's A Man Alone. She wanted to make this record about love and loneliness and loss.
It was drama all the time, but I fueled that fire with her because I just loved her so much. And I think, you know, we got along so well because she knew how much I loved her and respected her and the music. And we made a really extraordinary record.
Little did we know that when we were making A Single Woman, that it would be Nina's last full-length recording. We made the record in about 93, and she passed in 2003. And but the beautiful thing about her music is that it really does live on, because we have these wonderful stations these days like Pandora and the likes of them, and I always hear her voice. So her spirit is just always in the air, and I love that, and I feel it all the time, and she'll never leave me. I love that. Yeah.
Michael turns and makes his way down the sidewalk. On a city sidewalk, Michael passes under a sign that reads, "What to see and do in New Orleans." He pauses before a wrought iron gate and looks through it at the statue of Andrew Jackson on a horse in Jackson Square. In the French Quarter, he makes his way down the sidewalk.
Pick up the pieces that the puzzle made, from scraps of dreams out of focus and afraid. Make up the reasons for the words that were said, from scraps of dreams that trap the screams.
He picks up a string of Mardi Gras beads off the street.
Oh, these are broken. Oh, these don't look broken. Oh, cool. Good morning. It's about 7 a.m. and I'm on Bourbon Street in New Orleans. Site of my worst drinking and drugging.
Obviously, you're in bars and you're drinking. You're hanging out enough at these places. You start to know the bartenders. They're giving you free drinks. You're hanging out with bands.
It was done by people all throughout the industry, you know. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, from the musicians to the managers to the road crew to the record company people. You know, anyone who was involved and was privy to the celebration, which was really just the music industry itself, was cause enough for a celebration.
Everybody's getting a little buzz on. That's part of the program at that age. So for that scene at that time, that was the thriving thing. Everybody's getting the buzz on to enhance whatever the craziness that was taking place. So it was pretty widely accepted. It definitely did its damage in our band. Did damage in a lot of bands that we saw through time, you know, like that kind of thing. But it was just part of the program, for sure. Like, I know that there was a certain thing when I got in the band that I had to hold my own when it came to that in order to be in the band.
Finish this, and we'll see if you can hang with us. That was kind of this whole mentality. And, God, Michael definitely drank enough for all of us. Drugged enough for all of us, and all of the other stuff that goes along with that.
James Hetfield.
I think we all grew up similar that way. It's kind of like this rebellious attitude. That was the dark, ugly side of it.
Because when you're young and you're in a rock band and you go on the road for the first time and you've read Circus magazine and all your heroes are drug addicts and alcoholics, and so you want to do that too.
I'll tell you this, throughout the 90s, being in Pantera, everything was about drinking. Everything.
I was doing cocaine. I was doing ecstasy. Then it just got bad.
I remember we ran out of cocaine one night, and it was like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and we would shoot up to Harlem on 150th Street and, like, go pick up, like, crazy maniacs and go pick up an 8-ball at 4 o'clock in the morning and be up until 12, 1 o'clock or the next night. Like, we were completely mental.
I got a story. I'm driving in New York City one night. That was during the day, rather. I'm driving, and there he is walking down the street. I'm screaming, "Michael, Michael!" And he's just walking, and he turns around, he's looking around, "Fuck you!" He starts fucking swearing. I'm like, wow, he's fucking jacked. I'm like, "Michael, fuck you!" He's all fucked up walking down the street. I was like, holy shit. Like, he was lost. Didn't know who I was.
Beer wasn't enough. Vodka wasn't enough. Jägermeister wasn't enough. The blackouts weren't enough. Why do I have a receipt for minus $1,000 from Citibank in my pocket? I started then doing crack cocaine.
He was one of those people, and we all knew them. We'd go like, you know, if you get that phone call that that person died, you wouldn't be shocked. And I hate saying that. That's a horrible thing to say. But, you know, but that was so much of that in the air with people. Just people that are like, how long can someone exist in such a state of chaos without something bad happening?
I remember being down here, going to a crack den, and not even knowing how I got there. The last thing I had remembered was I was in New York City. Oof, scary shit.
They take everybody down. You don't know about it until you have it in your life and actually see it happen to somebody. You don't understand it. You know, they say it's a fucking disease. And you don't believe them. Like, ah, yeah, you can stop, you can stop. I can stop. Some people can't. You know, it's like a fucking, an addictive personality gene. I don't have it. You know, but some people do. They try a drug, they're nuts. That's it.
You know, normally you walk around with someone, they're like, oh man, I got really hammered at that bar one night, and I remember I threw up and they put me in a cab and they sent me home. You know, like, wow, I got crazy. Michael's stories involve, you know, craziness that ensues for not like one night, but like 3 weeks. Like, we wrote and we did this and we stayed up all night. And then, of course, the characters that he's listing in his stories, at a certain point, you're like, how can this guy be living and breathing at this point in time? And he is.
Michael Iago did not give a shit. I saw him plenty of times. I mean, I remember when I was still drunk and like having to haul Michael out of potential fights with big guys, him being like, you know, ready to go, you know, ready to fucking fight.
So we left kind of in the middle of Guns N' Roses, and we're walking through the parking lot, and there's this kid that kind of looks like a young James Hetfield and just looking like getting into trouble. And Alaga goes, oh, you know what? Do you guys want our passes? Because we're leaving. We laughed. We had fun. We got to go. Just being Alaga and being generous. Well, they kind of were like, said no. And he was like, oh, whatever. You know, and we kept walking. And all of a sudden, the one that looked like James Hetfield came running up from behind and kicked Michael in the ass like he was running to punt a football. And I was like, oh, my God. And then it was on. It was like this big fight. And I'm a chick. Like, I'm getting out of it. I'm like backing out of this. And next thing you know, I'm not kidding, it was like a cartoon. You just see a ball of fur flying in the air. All of a sudden, that big ball of fur just went flying across the parking lot. Bam! Michael on top of the kid. He's got him slammed up against the bumper of a car. He's got one hand grabbing the kid's hair, one hand grabbing his nuts. And he's like, I eat kids like you for breakfast. I will never forget that in my life.
Don't fuck with Michael Iago. Could be the subtext of the documentary. Because if you're an asshole, he will put you in deep check.
I think I told you about when I pissed on the cop's leg. You know, I think that was like the part of the worst 5 years and the last 5 years of my drinking and drugging. I think, well, I remember also waking up in St. Vincent's Hospital with IVs coming out of my arm.
There were some things going on with his lifestyle and the drugs. And it was like, you know, a lot of people who were doing those things at the time didn't come out of it.
I remember when I was living in Brooklyn in Carroll Gardens, you would just see these men withered and walking with canes and covered in sores, and you knew they were going to die. And you were seeing that all over New York. And you knew they were going to die. People that had HIV were going to die. It was the 80s, and that's the way it was.
And I started hearing stories about Michael being very ill.
So I went to see Michael one day, and I looked at him, and he was really skinny, you know, like particularly tiny, you know. And I just looked at him, and he just went, yeah, you know.
You know, all the images of my friends being sick, who I've lost, all of a sudden just like popped into my head when Michael told me that he was HIV positive. And I remember the first thing I did, which is what I you know, which was my habit, was just to hug, you know, my friends and kind of like let them know that, you know, I'm there for them.
So it was very, 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 very hard to deal with. You know, because back then, everybody was dying of AIDS. How is he going to survive? You know, he's my brother. You know, I love him. It was tough.
They didn't have the cocktails refined the way they do now. I think there were things he wasn't taking because he didn't like the reaction that he was having to them.
Michael was fading, and I didn't think he was going to make it, and I couldn't imagine a world without him in it.
There was a moment when it seemed that he was getting near the end, and it was a very bleak day. I went over to see him, and, you know, he could barely move. And what made it really horrible is his cat was really sick, too. So his cat was kind of mangy and wandering around completely out of it, too, and he was out of it. And it was just so sad.
It wasn't once, it was two or three times that he suddenly rallied again. One day I hear Michael's dying, the next day Michael's back, rallied. Michael's, no, he's fine. Okay. Then a year later or something, I hear Michael's got pneumonia or he's very ill, blah, blah, blah. So we stayed, I called him during those days. I remember having some intense conversations over the phone with him. And he was very brave and very hopeful, although I must admit there were times when I called him and he would just say, I can't talk now. I'm so sick. I can't talk now.
And then
Eric Bogosian.
I don't know. It had to be within months of this period. They came up with these pills, these cocktail. And at first he kind of gets stabilized and then he starts getting healthy again.
Michael was fine and started this whole new career as a photographer and a great one. And
Cherry Vanilla.
All these years later, he's still fine. And it's one of those miracles from that period where we lost so many friends and where we thought we were losing him.
He's at the lucky end of a generation because just a few years, let's say like, he's very lucky.
Thank God he took the opportunity to get clean because God knows where he would be.
When he finally told me that, like, he was going to meetings and he was going to, I was like, thank God, because you know what? You need to get yourself on track.
I like to look at it as there's a bottom you hit. There's a gift. You either scrape across it for a while,
James Hetfield.
You get the help you need somehow, some way, or you realize I can't live like this anymore. If I want to live, I need to change.
You know, back in the day, drinking and drugging, you know, one, myself, you know, you have all sorts of, like, you know, resentments and stuff, and it's like, ooh, thank God, in my sobriety, I have grown up. And in growing up, you just let things go. Because all that stuff is stuff from the past. And you know what? I don't want to live with any of that because it is the past. And you grow and you learn. And you learn to love. And you learn to not live in fear. And when you do that, you know, life just becomes really kind of beautiful.
Creation, destruction. Creation, destruction. You got to destroy yourself to create yourself. That's the name of the game. That's life, you know. In order to feel joy, you need to suffer. It's this paradox, which brings us full circle to what Michael Alago is. The paradox of the business, the gay scene, the photography scene, the poet scene, you know, everything.
You know, he went through a lot with that whole music business world. I remember Michael telling me he didn't want to do it anymore and he was just going to take pictures. I just want to, like, meet boys on the street and take their photo.
And I turned around, here was this guy, and he was like, hi, my name is Michael Lago, and I'm a photographer, and just, just, you know, really just on it, and he was sure of himself. And
can I take your picture? And I go, I'm going to take my picture? And he goes, yeah. And I go, okay. And he goes, can you make a muscle? And I go, you sure? Make a muscle? I didn't know anything about this guy.
I'm thrilled to see that, like,
there's a photographer eye in there, and I don't know what this all amounts to. I suspect it's a bit Mapplethorpe-induced. Which is not a bad thing either.
He knew Robert Mapplethorpe. He's definitely an influence on what Michael's doing. There's just no doubt about it. But Michael, even before that, even before he became a photographer, when he was an A&R person, Michael always had the camera. And that's why you've got the shots of a young Michael with Bono. You've got the shots of a young Michael with Johnny Lydon.
I went to a Mapplethorpe exhibition in New York a while back, I got extremely racy crotch stuff, you know, but I liked it because it was absolutely threatening, you know, it was in your face, so to speak. But you've got to be breaking down, and art is all about shock and attacking taboos, for me. And I've no doubt Michael's going to be breaking more than a few taboos. Well done, lad.
John Lydon stares intently at the camera. On Christopher Street in Manhattan, Michael photographs his friend, Marlon Connolly, a shirtless, muscular, tattooed man.
I love to have people close their eyes in pictures because what happens is someone like this who you don't think is approachable, all of a sudden, in my mind's eye, he becomes vulnerable because he's dreaming. I just like that little bit of vulnerability. So, there.
On a TV talk show, Michael is interviewed.
And then, of course, that leads us to what you're currently working on, which is photography.
Yeah.
And it is a particularly, you have a very clear inspiration.
It's no secret that Michael loves his muscle men, so those were his first subjects. Like, write what you know, do what you know. So Michael went right for that, and it was absolutely correct.
If I was telling people what Michael Alago did as a photographer, I would have to say he photographed men. Strong men, big men, muscle men, of a type that can be a little intimidating, who always seem to be really ready to give something to Michael, who really seem to respond to his camera and be kind of open to him. Michael has a kind of tender take on them, I think, and that's what makes his work kind of unique. I do think he's kind of documenting a tribe of tattooed, muscled, tough guys whose sexuality is very much up front, but also not exactly defined, except in Michael's obsessive take on that.
It was perfect. When he started telling me he was doing that, it was like, it never occurred to me that he should do that, but when he started describing what he was doing, and telling me, it was like, well, yeah, that's perfect. That's absolutely what you should be doing now. And it was just, and he's good at it, and he's passionate about it. There's a whole other side to the art from where he's coming from with that, you know? And it's like, that it just made perfect sense to me. And it's good.
I mean, I look at his photos every single day. They're right there as you come into my apartment, and they're right there, and every day you get to look at them, and they're amazing. The backs of the guys' heads with the chains and stuff, awesome shit.
He is doing something historic in some ways. He's documenting a type of guy that he finds attractive, that many other people find attractive, that exists right now and wasn't around 20 years ago and may not be quite the same 20 years from now. So it's the same way I think of Robert Mapplethorpe's early pictures of black men who don't quite look the same these days, that he's documenting a certain period of people. And I think a lot of photographers who get very intensely into their time, even going back to August Sander, you're looking at a document of a particular time and place.
You know, to see him now, so beautiful, so healthy, so robust, and have this career that he loves, completely different from the career he had. It's not nice to say, okay, because we thought he was going to die, it made us love him that much more. But it did do something for all of us. It made our relationship, our love for Michael, much more affectionate. We all wanted to just hug him all the time, because it's nice to have somebody still with you who you thought for sure you were losing. He's one of the survivors of my crowd, my time. So I can't help but just feel like, yeah, you and me, babe, we're still here, we made it, you know?
As far as I'm concerned, music is what keeps me young. It's what keeps my soul alive. And I think, like, having hung out with Michael at shows, it's the same thing with him. Like, it keeps you ageless. And he still has the same passion that he had, you know, 40-something years ago. Although Michael's not a musician, he's an artist in his own sense. And he never lost that passion.
You don't outgrow it. I mean, it's something that you would...
James Hetfield.
It fuels me. It fuels my life. And there's no doubt that it fuels Michael's life.
Michael Lago and I see eye to eye because we're down to earth. He is a down to earth guy. I guess that's what I've struggled with the most, is the fame and the popularity and how other people perceive you as this untouchable rock star fucking thing. It sucks. It's bullshit. I am just like anyone else, a music fucking freak. A music fan, a music nerd, if you will. That's what I see in Mike.
I always wish Michael the best, man. I would fucking probably kill somebody for him. I think he's great. He's one of a kind, man. He really is.
I just hope that he just keeps on going as long as the rest of us do. And I hope that we can all be hanging out in that dressing room in the sky together someday, just looking back at all of this going, we did good. We did good for ourselves, and we did good for the people who were around us at that time, and we did good for the music.
John Lydon.
Well, let's hope good people win, you know? Because he'll be there with that. And that doesn't need necessarily huge public accolades. It's that, you know, you've done the best and you've done nothing to hurt or destroy another human being. Fantastic. Absolutely. He stands really rigidly in my very small collection of very important people that don't lie.
And I was talking to him and I had this flashback of seeing Patti Smith at CBGB's. I think it was 76 or 77. And this is when you'd reserve a table at CBGB's. Well, and I'd get there in the afternoon to get a good seat. And there was about 10 people online already. I look up at the front of the line, and you always wonder at a rock concert, who's at the front of the line? And there was this little Spanish kid at the front of the line, feminine-looking guy, and I remember looking at him saying, he must be a real rock and roll fan.
Credits, cast in order of appearance. Cheryl Alago, Cherry Vanilla, Sheeta Chrome, John Lydon, Rob Zombie, Eric Bogosian, Cindy Lauper, and Mike Gitter. Michael holds up a scrapbook with a Ted Nugent sticker on it.
Don't ask how Ted Nugent got here, because I have no idea. I must have fancied him back in the day.
Michael stands under a street sign that reads, Joey Ramone Place.
So if you're in New York City and you go to 2nd Street in the Bowery, you can see a sign on a pole that says Joey Ramone Place, and that's because of our great Arturo Vega. He got the street named after Joey. And that's really kind of cool.
Eric Bogosian.
In such an unapologetic point of view that just says, this is the way I think, fuck you. And you got a problem with this? Isn't this great? Look at this fucking guy. He's got a fucking dick 10 feet long, and how amazing is that? It's like, yeah, that's a big dick, all right, you know, whatever the picture might be.
Credits. Cast in order of appearance continued. Dito Montiel, Anton DeSantis, Daniel Ray, Jerry Brandt, Phil Cavano, and Danny Fields. In a recording studio, Michael watches James Tamazzaro Brady of Borgo Pass record vocals. Slow it down. Michael.
Here we are on Hollywood Boulevard and the Walk of Fame with all the great stars. We're not exactly in the center of it all, but, you know, I guess if you get a star on Hollywood Boulevard, that would be really, really cool. So I'm thinking, because this star is empty, this is my star on Hollywood Boulevard. It's not exactly prime real estate, but you know what? I'll take it.
Yeah, you could be, look, you could be right next to...
I could be right...
It would be the Osmond family.
And Michael Alago. I love it. Hollywood, here I come.
Credits, cast in order of appearance continued. Debbie Southwood-Smith, Kurt Vanderhoof, Lars Ulrich, Gavin Van Vlack, Kurt Hammett, James Hetfield, Phil Anselmo, Sean Isolt, John Joseph, Jason Newsted, and Joe Sibb.
Oh, I do remember one show that was kind of great at CB's, this UK band called Chelsea, and they had a singer named Gene October, and I think I was a little more than tipsy, but right after they did their set, I just grabbed him and took him home for the night.
Credits. Cast in order of appearance continued. Carol Friedman, Mina Caputo, Doyle Wolfgang von Frankenstein, Jimmy Marino, Marlon Conley, and Vince Aletti. Antone DeSantis.
At the Ritz, a lot of people were doing blow. Like, so I'd go into Michael's office and there were people just... So occasionally somebody would be like, here, yeah, I wouldn't be like, oh, can I just have some of your blow? But most people would offer it to you anyway. And then next thing you know, you're high on coke, not that you really wanted it to be, you know?
On a city street, Michael with a man wearing a Metallica t-shirt and holding a bottle of liquor in a paper bag.
I went to this party the other night.
Right there at the dungeon.
The band there was out of sight. You know, everybody was screaming, shout, the singing rock out with your cock out. Don't you know it's gonna be a hit? Cause everybody's always singing it. Everybody screams and shout, they're singing rock out with your cock out.
Dito Montiel.
Funny thing, I was walking down on 8th Avenue once, near where he lives, and I'm walking by some hardcore gay bookstore, you know, I don't know what the hell goes on in there, you know, one of these places where you could probably still buy a locker room, or you know, and I see a picture of my boots in the window. I'm like, hey, those are my fucking, I think those are my boots, and under it says Ditto's Boots, and it's fucking Mike Galago photographs.
Credits. Stone Films NYC is the author of this motion picture for the purpose of copyright and other laws. Copyright 2017. Michael Alago.
I'm ready when you are.